right. So let's pick up where we left off, or step back a little bit from the end of last lecture. So we were finishing up with description of the Griffiths-Dork technique for determining Picard-Fuchs differential equations for families of hypersurfaces in projective space. So this is now a recall, since we did this last time, but let's recall the Griffiths-Dork technique. So it applies to X, hypersurface in Pn, defining polynomial Q, and we also let J of Q denote the Jacobian ideal, coming from the, are generated by the partials with respect to the various variables and homogeneous coordinates on Pn. And we also commented that this H of X, this Durham cohomology rational forms with poles along X, every class can be represented by something of the form P dot omega naught over Q to the K, where P is a polynomial whose degree we described last time, Q is the defining polynomial for X, omega naught is the standard holomorphic, the Beeney-Studi holomorphic form on projective space. And there were three basic ingredients to the Griffiths-Dork approach. The first is the principle of reduction of pole order. Okay, you want it bigger. You want it bigger. So I'll do it bigger. So reduction of pole order. So if we have, if we have some k, which is the sum over I, ai partial q, partial xi, in Jacobian of q, then we have the expression omega naught over q to the k plus 1, sum over I, ai, dq, dxi, can be written as 1 over k, omega naught over q to the k, sum I, partial ai, partial xi, plus stuff that doesn't matter. And what doesn't matter is exact terms. Okay, so that's the first ingredient. The next ingredient is the residue map. So this, for smooth hypersurfaces at least, is going to be an isomorphism onto primitive cohomology. So res from our Durham cohomology H n minus 1 xc is given by the formula 1 over 2 pi I integral. Now we define these tubes about middle dimensional cycles in our hypersurfaces, so T tube about gamma. P omega naught over q to the k is integral over gamma residue P omega naught over q to the k. Okay, and the third ingredient, which once you have a notion of the Arisman connection, as I said, which justifies moving your family of middle dimensional cycles, and for that matter, their associated tubes. You can talk about a formula which is, I wrote down last time, which is essentially differentiation under the integral sign. Okay. Now, the observation is that if you let R be the dimension over C of H m minus 1 x, then only r minus 1 derivatives can be linearly independent. Okay. Now note, this is independent the number of multi-indices we have in our deformation family. So T, the index T I introduced last time, would be T1 through TR. Okay, so we can do this in a PDE sense as well. So this means that the periods must satisfy a linear differential equation with coefficients in, well, okay, strictly speaking, I could say rational functions, coefficients in C, but in fact, there'll be coefficients in Q if we start with integral coefficients to begin with. But I'll just write it this way, Q, T1 through TR, of order less than or equal to R. Okay? And so this is the Picard-Fuchs differential equation. Okay? So that is the linear differential equation coming from the fact that only R minus one derivatives can be linearly independent. All right. So let's actually do an example. Let's specialize this to the case of elliptic curves in Weierstrass normal form. So here our Q is y squared z minus 4x cubed plus g2xz squared plus g3z cubed. G2 and g3 then are the deformation parameters. And as I mentioned last time, you want to differentiate, at least at first, with respect to the monomial deformation parameters in your presentation. So you differentiate under the integral sign, and this gives you, well, partial g2 of integral omega naught over q is minus integral xz squared omega naught over q, and partial g3 integral omega naught over q is minus integral z cubed omega naught over q, and q squared, of course, in both of them. Now, with the Grosvenor basis calculation, and effectively almost anything you do with Picard-Fuchs differential equations in the multiparameter setting is going to involve some Grosvenor basis calculations, even in one parameter. So Grosvenor basis calculation shows that xz squared is equivalent to z cubed modulo the Jacobian ideal in this case. So we can reduce pole order. So reduce pole order, and we obtain partial g2. So partial g2 integral omega naught over q minus 3/2 g3 over g2 partial g3 integral omega naught over q is minus 1 over 4 g2 integral omega naught over q. And according to what I've told you so far, that would be the Picard-Fuchs differential equation for the family of elliptic curves in Weierstrass normal form. Now, I'm willing to wager that almost no one in the audience, probably the graybeards included, has ever thought of this as being the Picard-Fuchs differential equation for a family of elliptic curves, because no one ever writes it this way. Okay? We already saw last time that the moduli space for elliptic curves, which we denoted, I'll try to respect these bounds, which we denoted ME. Yeah.
So what did you say about the two
coefficients? Oh, well, under the assumption that the original coefficients in the defining hypersurface are integral, then you're not doing anything that's going to introduce roots. So that's at this really, really rough level. Notice we haven't done the of T parameterization yet. Once you do that, all bets are off. All right. But we're not going to pay attention to those details today. So the moduli space ME is one-dimensional. Okay? So it's natural to consider cases where G2 and G3 are themselves functions of a single variable t. Okay, now this begins to look more like what one is used to doing. So if we do this, then you have to, basically apply the chain rule systematically and consistently, okay, and repeat all of the basic principles, the reduction of pole order, the residue map and differentiation under the integral sign, especially the first and third, with respect to the t differentiation. Okay, so nothing difficult, just tedious, and hence good to teach a computer to do. So what happens in particular when we take our, just do the first derivative with respect to t in this case? So we do ddt, integral omega naught over q. Well, that's minus g2 prime of t, prime being, of course, the t derivative, integral x, so that's square omega naught over q squared, minus g3 prime of t, integral z cubed omega naught over q squared. Okay? And then you rinse and repeat. So repeat to the, well, r minus first derivative, in this case, to the second derivative, I guess rth derivative, second derivative, and use reduction of pole order and Grosvenor basis for comparison with what's in the Jacobian ideal, and results of differentiation under the integral sign. Dot, dot, dot. Okay, so at the end of the day, we can rewrite the result in terms of delta, which we defined last time to be g2 cubed minus 27 g3 squared, and j, which we defined last time to be g2 cubed over delta. So the conclusion, now that we're working with the of t form, we're working with an ordinary differential equation, second order, independent variable t, the conclusion is that we get the following expression. We get d squared dt squared, and remember that our holomorphic one form, in the case of Weierstrass normal form, could be written as dx over y, or prefer dx over the square root of 4x cubed minus g2x minus g3. So it's d squared dt squared of integral dx over y plus some rational function in g2, g3, and their derivatives. I'll call it b1, ddt, integral dx over y, plus b naught, integral dx over y, equals 0. Now, I'm getting tired of writing integral dx over y. I'm going to try to factorize these operators in the future and just put an operator with parentheses around it hitting a function. Okay? But what are b1 and b naught? Well, b1, and you'll see a suspiciously large number of logarithmic derivatives enter this expression, it's g3 prime over g3 minus g2 prime over g2 plus j prime over j minus j double prime over j prime. And b naught is j prime squared over 144 j, j minus 1 plus delta prime over 12 delta b1 plus delta double prime over delta minus 13 twelfths delta prime over delta. Okay? So 12 plays a very prominent role in this, as you might expect, of the orbifold structure of the J-line. And when you're writing things in this way, you begin to see what is important from the standpoint of the fundamental modular parameter on the J line, J itself, and what is dependent upon the actual structure of the Weierstrass equation, the actual appearance of G2 and G3. Now, there is an operation, I won't describe it in detail, called projective normalization that can be applied to any linear ODE, and in particular applied to the second order equations. When you perform projective normalization, what you're doing is you're scaling all of the solutions, the entire solution space, by the same function of the independent variable T. And by doing this, you're altering which operator annihilates that space of functions. And there's a unique way to do this and produce an operator for which this B1 term would go to zero. Okay, and this is called the uniformizing differential equation. And if you rewrite, so if you write the, just a comment here, write the projective normal form of this second order differential equation, then you see everything, so all in terms of J itself. Okay. So I won't say many more there. But the beauty of the projective normalization procedure is that you focus on what's essential from the standpoint of modularity, and you wipe away any issues of normalization of forms on the varying family. Okay, but there's another way to see this, this focus on modularity. Let's take a specific example for which G2 and G3 have especially nice behavior and are ridiculously simple functions of J. In fact, what I'm going to take is the special case where G2 of T is equal to 27T over T minus 1, and G3 of T is equal to G2 of T. Okay? So, very, very special elliptic surface. Okay? Because now we can take any elliptic surface E over P1 in the sense that Matthias introduced yesterday, and we can play this game to describe the Picard-Fuchs differential equation for the family of elliptic curves over the base. P1 is inessential. We can do this on a chart, on any curve. And in fact, as we saw before, we can take partial derivatives, so you could in principle play this game for families of elliptic curves over a many, many dimensional base. As mathematicians, we probably wouldn't care, but our friends in physics do. It's the entry ingredient for something they call F-theory, which is important for heterotic model building. All right, but let's take this elliptic surface. Then when you plug in, and plug and chug, you get d squared dt squared plus 1 over t ddt plus, and it's 31 over 144 t minus 1 over 36 over t squared t minus 1 squared as the operator. Okay? This operator is Fuchsian with regular singular points at regular singular points at 0, 1, and infinity, t equals 0, 1, and infinity. And it's easy to see what the monodromes are. I'm going to write up the monodromes in PSL2. Okay, so this is not quite geometric. Okay, but I'm throwing in the P there so that you recognize the matrices immediately. The monodromes about 0, G0 is 1, 1, minus 1, 0. About G1 is 0, minus 1, 1, 0. And about G infinity, 1, 1, 0, 1. So in particular, infinity is the standard cusp. Okay? So this canon should look familiar. And in essence, what we've done here is we've considered an elliptic surface whose base projective line, it's fibered over a projective line, and the coordinate in the base projective line is almost exactly the elliptic modular function J, or rather, it's reciprocal. I'll erase this now. So is John Mackay here? As I said, if you look at t equal infinity is what we call the cusp, or in more general setting, it's a point of maximal unipotent monodromy. And T of Q itself, if you let Q be e to the 2 pi I tau, tau defined as before as the ratio of periods, T of Q is just J of Q. It's 1 over Q plus 744 plus 196884 Q plus 21493760 Q squared plus big O Q cubed. And what is more natural from the standpoint of generalizations to Calabi-Yau manifolds, let's move that point of maximally unipotent monodromy to zero and look for an expression which is locally holomorphic. So Z of Q, which is 1 over T of Q, is Q minus 744 Q squared plus 356652 Q cubed minus 14036115 2 Q to the fourth plus big O Q to the fifth. And this is the simplest example of what's known as the mirror map. So this, so this is the Q series expansion for the elliptic modular function, and it's reciprocal with regard to this family. So this Z of Q is an elementary example of the so-called mirror map. Okay. Now, what's critical in picking it here was that we actually had this maximally unipotent monodromy behavior. Here it's unipotent of rank 1, but more generally, if you're dealing with Calabi-Yau threefolds, you're going to want unipotency of rank 3. And this is actually a rather strong geometrical condition on the nature of the degeneration of the family of Calabi-Yau manifolds. It's as close to total degeneracy as you can get, including total degeneracy. So what you want to do in terms of a general definition of the mirror map is you identify one of these points of maximally unipotent monodromy, and about that you look for a holomorphic solution to Picard-Fuchs, a solution which behaves with logarithmic behavior, one with log squared behavior, you put them into a projectivized period vector in this form, and then you locally invert the expression of the log solution over the holomorphic solution near zero. Okay, zero is the point of maximally unipotent monodromy. So we can do this not just for elliptic curve families, of course, but also for K3 surface families, for Calabi-Yau threefold families, etc. And a reasonable question to ask is, when is the mirror map Q series a modular function? Okay. So there's a general solution in the case of X being an elliptic curve or a K3 surface. Okay. In the case of elliptic curve, the answer is essentially reduced to whether the elliptic surface involved is itself an elliptic modular surface. Okay. In the K3 surface case, a satisfactory answer in complete generality and arbitrary number of parameters is given in the context of the generalization of a uniformizing differential equation from a curve to a higher dimensional base. Neither of these is something I want to dwell on today. what I would like to mention, and the reason I brought this up, is that in the case of Calabi-Yau threefolds, even this famous quintic mirror pencil that is going to be discussed in Radu's next talk, in the case of Calabi-Yau threefolds, there is an obstruction to classical modularity. Now, this is modularity, by the way, in the sense of the last of the list in Noriko's abstract of notions of modularity. It's what she would call geometric modularity. I think you said you wouldn't have time to talk about it. So there's an obstruction to this classical modularity in the sense of modularity with respect to subgroups of PSL2R, but it's a very active subject of research to explore what the meaning of modularity should be for these Calabi-Yau families, in particular these pencils with small Hodge numbers. Yeah, and I'm about to do that. So I would say the entry point for this subject that I would suggest would be Yamaguchi and Yao, if you're physically minded. And lucky us, Hossein Movasadi will be giving a talk on exactly this subject at our conference. Okay? You may notice that I have a number of detours which lead me squarely to someone's talk. And that's part of the art of giving these lectures. All right. So now I think we've pretty much exhausted elliptic curves. I promised that today would be about K3s. So yeah. Right, well, elliptic curves are self-mirror in a very reasonable sense. So I'm not going to give a formal definition of the mirror map, and that wasn't my purview here. But I would like to emphasize that these so-called mirror map Q-series that people encounter in the case of elliptic curves and K3 surfaces are really nothing but Q-series expansions for, functions which, if they extend globally, will be automorphic. That's the point. Okay. And characterizing when they extend globally is very easy, and that's something I did back in my thesis too many years ago. Having said that, it is certainly interesting to look at the class of K3 surfaces and their behavior with respect to modular parameterization, and that's what we're going to talk about next, without actually bringing in any physics to the discussion. So let's move from elliptic curves to K3 surfaces, and let's specifically look at the generalization of the Hesse pencil. So what we're going to talk about next is the Fermat-Quartic pencil. Okay. So the so-called Fermat-Quartic pencil. Now, XT, I guess I'll just call it XT, is given by x to the fourth plus y to the fourth plus z to the fourth plus w to the fourth plus t times x, y, z, w, and t is the deformation parameter there, so I'll underline it, equals zero in CP3. Now, the Fermat-Quartic pencil, as we're about to see, has generic Picard rank, in the sense introduced yesterday in yesterday's lectures, of 19. Okay, so the largest dimensional irredundant family from the sense of surjectivity of the period mapping that you would expect is a one-dimensional family, and we have a one-dimensional family. Okay, so this is good. Let's see how one can argue that the generic Picard rank is 19. So for generic P and P1, let's define the group G to be Z mod 4Z squared acting on XT by sending X to lambda times X, Y to mu times Y, mu times Y, Z lambda inverse mu inverse times Z. And here lambda and mu are fourth roots of unity. Now, you can look at the induced action on cohomology of XT, and it fixes the holomorphic 2 form called omega T on XT. So this is what's known as a symplectic action, or symplectic involution here. Symplectic action. And so by a result of Nikulin, there's a classification of these symplectic actions on K3 surfaces. we know that there exists a particular rank 18 negative definite sublattice in Naron-Severi of XT. Well, that's pretty good. You're just taking care of a lower bound of 18 for the rank. Okay. But what are we missing? Well, that's a negative definite lattice. And this surface, these surfaces, family of surfaces, these are obviously, I mean, they're quartic surfaces, right? They're obviously four polarized, to take the hyperplane class. So the hyperplane class has, of course, positive square. So you combine the hyperplane class with this rank 18 sublattice, and then you're guaranteed to have a rank 19 sublattice of Naron-Severi. So with the fixed four polarization class, we get that the rank of pick in Naron-Severi of XT is at least 19. Okay. What if it's 20? What if it's uniformly 20, right? That's a problem. But it's really easy to see that this family is not isotrivial. Okay, there is an actual, genuine, complex structure variation going on. So family not isotrivial, and one hallmark of being not isotrivial is the existence of something analogous to the cusp that Matthias talked about in the elliptic curve case yesterday. The family of elliptic curves, where you have a Cadira type IN or IN star fiber, cannot possibly have constant J invariant. It's analogous here. Family not isotrivial implies that the Picard rank XT is not generically equal to 20. So we conclude that XT has generic Picard rank equal to 19. Okay. And you could reasonably think of the Fermat quartic tensile itself as being a normal form for K3 surfaces of some lattice polarization type associated to this this description. But I want us to remember another lesson from my introduction, my thematic introduction to the first lecture. Once you have an algebra-geometric construction of a Calabi-Yau, if symmetry is present, what should you do? You should use it to construct new geometry. Okay? So symmetry is present. We use the symmetry to argue that we have a rank 19 sublattice, a rank 19, you know, Picard lattice. We use that symmetry to argue that. Why don't we use the symmetry geometrically? Let's just quotient by it and resolve. Okay? So if we quotient, so quotient each XT by G and resolve, which you can do and still preserve the K3-ness of the fibers, we get a family YT of K3 surfaces. Okay? This has a name. It's known as the mirror quartic tensile. Okay. Now, just a few words about this. Again, I'm not giving lectures about physics, and the motivation for physics is so ancient at this point, and these structures so vastly predate the arrival of physicists in this game that I hesitate to overemphasize physics in this regard. But what I will say is that it's called the mirror quartic tensile, both because this operation of quotienting and resolving was a special case of a general construction of Green and Plesser, the very first construction of mirror pairs by Green and Plesser. And you'll notice that there's no mention of Fermat here. We don't call it the mirror Fermat quartic tensile. It's just a mirror cortic pencil. And that's because under the mechanism of mirror symmetry, this one parameter family, YT, of generically Picard rank 19 K3 surfaces is mirror to any cortic. Because the complex structure on this family is mirror to the Kähler structure on the other family. And the Kähler structure on the other family is merely the four polarization, the fact that it came from a cortic at all. Okay? So this is a good name, mirror cortic pencil, perfectly reasonable, and in fact it's entered the math literature at this point. What is the corresponding lattice? Pardon? Yeah. Well, the Picard number is at least 19. You can argue that similarly, and Ursula has a nice description of this in her thesis. Theses are great places to look for concrete descriptions of things. And Ursula did a nice job with that. In fact, what is the polarizing lattice? Well, the polarizing lattice is what I will call M sub 2, which I'll denote H plus E8 plus E8 plus minus 2. Oops, minus 4. Factor 2n. Now, comment on notation, okay? So we're going to see a lot of descriptions of the K3 lattice in lectures in this next week. There are two competing but entirely compatible notations for the hyperbolic lattice of rank 2. Okay, Dave Morrison likes to call it H. I learned that aspect of the subject from him many years ago. So H is fine, but I mean H, I'm going to just say H equals U equals 0110, and let's just leave it at that. Okay, the E8s. Sometimes people put minus signs on them. I don't know. I mean, to me, E8 is always going to be negative definite because I am a geometer. Okay? But I agree that depending who you are, who are theorists, you might want to put a minus sign on the E8. That's fine, too. But in any case, that's the polarizing lattice, and if there's any ambiguity, please ask. Okay. Why do I put a minus 4? I need minus 4. The signature would be wrong if I didn't put a minus sign there. Yeah. That I know. And in fact, why I almost messed up is it's minus 2n in general with a subscript n here. Okay? So I'll just introduce the notation. Mn is h plus e8 plus e8 plus minus 2n. Okay? Great. Now, there's another way to construct four polarized K3 surfaces with enhanced lattice polarization. Because after all, that's what we've got here, right? YT is it still has the four polarization because the four polarization was in fact a fixed class, right? So how can we construct? Yes. Anyway, this is the question: how can we construct four polarized K3 surfaces with an enhanced lattice polarization? And there's a variety of approaches, but the approach I'm going to talk about right now is to consider singular cortic surfaces. Okay? So singular cortic surfaces in P3. Now, as long as the singularities aren't too bad, you can resolve them and get another K3 surface. So if you have an ordinary double point singularity of ADE type, then we can engineer. This is actually called this geometrical engineering. Okay. You can engineer K3 surfaces with large negative definite sublattices of ADE type in the Naron-Savary groups. Now, after the lecture mentioning elliptic surfaces yesterday, you might say, oh, well, okay, that's great, but I really like elliptic curves, I really like elliptic surfaces, couldn't you give it to me as an elliptic surface? Okay, I will. Take any line, an actual line in CP3, on your cortic surface, and you get an elliptic vibration. Now, how does that work? Well, you take a line on your cortic surface, and now you take the family of planes passing through that line. The excess intersection of any plane passing through a line on a cortic surface, right, as long as the singularities aren't too bad, is going to be degree 3, and therefore define a pencil of cubics. Okay, and these are literally cubics in CP2. Couldn't be nicer. You might object, and you'd say, wait a minute, Abhinav asked that question yesterday, what about the section? And you do have to find a section. If you really want a section, you have to work a little bit harder to find the section. But generally speaking, what's going to happen is you'll find the section among the rational curves you get of ADE type coming from the singularity resolution. We'll see this in an example in a minute. All right, so I'll just say often can easily find a section, or maybe even multiple sections, and that gives you actually an H equals 0110 polarization. Okay, on the K3s. So elliptic vibration is equivalent to the square zero class, right? And this is the polarization by type H. So what's our key example going to be? So what we're going to do is we're going to look for the commonality in this M2 and MN. What's the common sublattice? Well, the common sublattice, pretty visibly, at least the obvious candidate, is H plus E8 plus E8. So let's do just this. Let's take H plus E8 plus E8, and since I won't be doing too much toric geometry, I'll call it M. It shouldn't lead to any real confusion. Define M to be H plus E8 plus E8. And we had the notion of lattice polarized K3 surfaces and their moduli yesterday. So let's let XI be an M polarized K3 surface. So just to remind you, you're going to have I embedding M into Nerin Severi of X. Okay. And the result I want to state here is completely analogous to the Weierstrass normal form for elliptic curves. Okay? So there exists a triple ABD in C3 with D non-zero such that XI are M polarized, H plus E8 plus E8 lattice polarized K3 surface, is isomorphic to the minimal resolution of the quartic surface QM ABD. So what is QM ABD? And those of you who are arithmetically minded might want a slightly different presentation, but I like this one because it was the first to appear in the literature in the work of Inose. It's a y squared zw minus 4 x cubed z plus 3a x z w squared plus b z w cubed minus 1/2 d z squared w squared plus w to the fourth equals 0. Okay, so just to be clear, this is a singular quartic hypersurface. I'll describe the singularities in a minute. They're not too bad. They are ordinary double points of ADE type. So the minimal resolution of this quartic surface is going to be a smooth K3 surface. And essentially, because of that resolution introducing all these rational curves, we're going to see that, or at least I'll state, that you fill out all of M in a natural way. So every smooth member of the resolved family, which I'll denote X, ABD, is naturally M-polarized. Okay. In fact, it goes both ways. Oops, I can't do that, can I? Pardon? No. We also have sections, so you have to worry about lines. And I mean, it's actually the singularity is actually a lie on lines, and one of them is the intersection of the two lines. So no, you have to be careful. Okay. Yes. Okay, so you've required me to divulge some punchlines, but I will do it. So M is a sublattice. Oops, I'm sorry. Is a superlattice of a lattice N. H plus E8 plus E7. Now I have two reasons for introducing the notation ABD. Okay, one of them is that D is the discriminant. Come on, that's a reason enough, right? But the other one is that if you add a single monomial, I think I made a point of writing it down. Yeah, so add C times X Z squared W, and you get a normal form QN A, B, C, D. And now that you forced me to divulge this, I will mention the modularity properties of this other family. And I should also say that Adrian Klinger is going to talk about a further inclusion, S, which is defined to be H plus E7 plus E7. Okay? No, actually, E and F. E and F. We have to work. Our hypersurface normal form is not as good in those cases. Now, the reason for the redundancy is exactly the reason for the redundancy in the case of G2 and G3. So we needed G2 and G3 to get a projective model for the modular curve, for the J-line, if you like, for elliptic curves. Here, ABD, even though we're going to have Picard rank generically 18, which would be a two-parameter family of K3s, in order to have a projective model for it. Okay. Likewise, ABCD. But you know this punchline because you were in band. That's true. All right. Okay, so let's finish the statement. Now, I promised it would be in perfect analogy with the Weierstrass normal form for elliptic curves, and indeed it is. So two such QM A1 B1 D1 and QM A2 B2 D2 determine isomorphic M polarized K3s, X A1 B1 D1 and X A2 B2 D2, if and only if A2 B2 D2 is equal to lambda squared A1 lambda cubed B1 and lambda to the sixth D1. Okay, for some lambda and C star. So this means that the coarse moduli space for M polarized K3 surfaces can be written as A, B, D, defining a point in weighted projective 2-3-6 space, D non-zero. And the fundamental invariance, generalizations of the expression of J in the elliptic curve case as G2 cubed over delta, are A cubed over D and B squared over D, of course. And now there's two of them instead of one of them. Okay. Now, as promised, so on QM ABD in P3, we have two distinct lines. Now you can read them off the equation, of course, but they are X equal W equals 0 and Z equal W equals 0. And there are two singular points of ABE type, and the singular points are P1, which is 0, 1, 0, 0, and P2, which is 0, 0, 1, 0. And if you resolve those singularities, again, generically, because there are special sublocii where this might be worse, you get ABE types A11 from P1 and E6 from P2. Okay. Now, I'm not going to do the fun game of writing out the resolution diagrams and then finding it. No, I'm not going to do that. But instead, what I'm going to do is mention the two elliptic vibrations that come from these two lines. So the two vibrations, well, the one induced from the line, the projection, I'll say, to ZW, this leads to the so-called standard vibration. Okay? It's the standard vibration because the singular fibers consist of two type 2 star Godiva fibers and four I1 Godiva fibers. I1s are just the nodes, the two stars are E8. So in this case, the lattice polarization, these come from the singular fibers, and this H comes from the fiber in section. Right? So that's dead easy. Right? That's standard. But the other projection, the projection to XW, is what we'll call the alternate vibration. And now you have an I12 star fiber and six I1s, generically. Now I'm going into this level of detail not because I'm so proud of how it looks and the result. No. It's because Matt Kerr needs this for his talk. And in fact, this particular family, because of the control of the modular parameterization I'm about to describe, we're actually able to derive some highly non-trivial results involving regulators in higher algebraic K theory. Okay, so how much time do I have? 5 minutes, sounds good. Okay, so what I want to say is that among the exceptional curves in resolving P1, in this case, are sections of both vibrations. And in resolving P2, you get a second section of the alternate vibration. Now, in fact, the standard vibration has only one section. The alternate vibration has two. And the act of translation by the second section, these are actually torsion, two torsion, right? The act of translation by the second section defines an involution on XABD. And this involution is the so-called Nikulin involution, which relates XABD to in this case, another K3 surface, which happens to be Coomer of the product of two elliptic curves. So what I barely have time to say, and I'm going to say in the last 3 minutes, is how you could have guessed this geometric fact from the Clausewitz differential equation. So the first thing I have to say is that, you know, this is a family of singular quartics, so you might say, oh, woe is us, the Griffiths-Dwork procedure fails. It only works for smooth projective hypersurfaces. Well, you might be right in some level of generality, but you're wrong in this case, because in this case, everything works rather beautifully. So Ursula Witcher will talk about how that works in this case and its generalization to the n-polarized case. So we do have a Picard-Fuchs differential equation we can write down. And the Picard-Fuchs differential equation, and I'm going to take here the chart on the base with A equal 1, takes the form of the following system, d squared dB squared minus 4d partial d squared minus 4 partial d. And let's let f as a function of b and d be an arbitrary period. And there's a second equation, minus 1 plus b squared plus d partial squared partial b squared plus 2b partial b plus 4bd partial squared partial b partial d plus 2d partial d plus 5 over 36 fbd equals 0. This is the precise analog of, well, if I'd done abd, it would be the precise analog, but it's the analog on an affine chart in the base of the general description I gave for the Griffiths-Dwork output for the wire stress family of elliptic curves. But there's a really nice reparametrization we can do here in terms of two variables, which I'm going to call J1 and J2, highly suggestively. So if you let b squared be j1 minus 1, j2 minus 1 over j1, j2, and d be 1 over j1, j2, then this system completely decouples. So you get 72 j1, 2 j1 minus 1, j1 partial squared partial j1 squared plus 2 j1 minus 1 partial partial j1 minus 5 f of j1 j2 equals 0, and exactly the same thing but with the roles in this operator of j1 and j2 reversed. Okay? Moreover, these second order operators with respect to the variables j1 and j2, you can show with an appropriate normalization, it turns out to be the fourth root of g2 of t, dx over y, precisely satisfy the Weierstrass normal forms, Picard-Fuchs differential equation. So we have Hodge theoretic evidence, if you will, although I haven't traced Hodge structures at all here, I could do so. Hodge theoretic evidence for the assertion via the Hodge conjecture that there should be an algebraic correspondence between M-polarized K3 surfaces and abelian surfaces A that split completely as a product E1 cross E2. Okay. And this is something that Klinger and I showed a number of years ago. It's in Michigan Math Journal. And we did it explicitly in families, but the key geometric fact boiled down to the fact that the alternate fibration has a second section. From translation by that second section, you get an involution, and that involution is a Nikulin involution, and the associated Nikulin involuted output is, we're relating Shiota indices in this case of E1 cross E2 to Coomer of E1 cross E2. Okay? Now, this generalizes in the n-polarized case to the case where E1 and E2, where A doesn't split, so you have a principally polarized abelian surface that does not split. And in the s-polarized case, it generalizes, but in a rather exciting way, to the Kusatake variety, which is the prim of a 4-to-1 cover of a genus 5 curve over an elliptic curve, which is an abelian fourfold, but that's a story for another day. Thank you. Yes, it is what you'd call M1 in the Ziegler spaces. It's C10 equals 0. So we've generalized all this story, right? We know that the ABCD parameters have a natural interpretation as E4, E6, C10 scaled by, I forget the appropriate power. No, it's the stupid Humbert surface, right? It's H1. Yeah. But we have all the Humbert surfaces described in similar. This is H1. Now, what I didn't have time to talk about was that, in fact, we have a complete differential algebraic characterization of all Humbert surfaces that Mosadi and I are working at right now. In this particular case, in the M-polarized family, already in published work, is a differential algebraic characterization of all of the MN curves. So the curves corresponding to the lattice polarization of type MN in the M-polarized family. So it's a condition for the lead term of the general of T parameterized Picard-Fuchs operator to disappear. So for a rank drop from 4 to 3, we have that generalization now for Humbert surfaces in the Ziegler modulo threefold. It's kind of ugly, but it's complete.